This is November 7th, 1984, the second lecture in the Carver Barnes lecture series presented by Dr. Professor Robert T. Handy, entitled Faith in Higher Education, Partners or Enemies.
Let us pray. Enable us to comprehend time. not only as the sum total of our individual experiences, but as the arena in which we as persons participate in the totality of social existence. Impress upon us the necessity of discerning the role of the Christian community in this setting, and the urgency of implementing our faith within that fleeting moment, which is ours. Amen. It is a privilege for me to introduce our lecturer this morning. When one attempts to assess the impact which this man has exerted upon the study of American Christianity thus far in the 20th century, one need look no farther than the productivity of his pen. Such titles as American Christianity, A Christian America, Protestant Hopes and Historical Realities, A History of the Churches in the United States and Canada, The Social Gospel in America, Religion in the American Experience, The Pluralistic Style, The Holy Land in American Protestant Life, to name only a few. These works have provided us with a framework in which we can better understand the development of Christianity in the United States. The insights which he continues to manifest in his teaching and research are a quality of his thinking which I first encountered in his classes during my student days at Union Seminary. It is indeed a pleasure for me to present to you this morning Professor Robert T. Handy, whose lecture this morning is entitled Faith and Higher Education, Partners or Enemies.
Thank you very much. A couple of years ago, I went to a conference in which we historians were trying to either inform each other or impress each other, as happens at these meetings. And it became laughable by the end, because everybody who came to the podium announced a change in the topic as printed in the program for that conference. Every single one introduced a change. My change is very slight this morning on my topic. I'm going to add a word. The title, Faith in Higher Education, Partners or Enemies, may be just a little presumptuous. I'm going to talk about Christian faith in higher education. I'm not going to deal with the faith of Judaism or Islam or Hinduism and higher education, but Christian faith and higher education. On both sides, both by those who profess to come at the relationship of faith and higher education from the side of religion, and by those whose primary commitment is to educational philosophies and practices, some have construed the relationship of faith and higher education in terms of enmity. Through the centuries, there have been many persons of faith who have come to regard the higher learning as inconsistent with faith and disruptive to it. That position was taken early in the centuries after Christ by certain leaders of Christian faith, conspicuous among them the polemical Tertullian. He was certainly among one of the most learned persons of his time. He was well and widely read in the law, in history, in philosophy of his day, of the late second century. But when he was converted to Christian faith, he labeled learning as a deceitful enemy. In an oft-quoted passage, he was satirically critical of Aristotle and all the philosophers, exclaiming, you've heard this many times, what then has Athens to do with Jerusalem? What the academy with the church? To us, there is no need of curious questioning now that we have Christ Jesus, nor of inquiry now that we have the gospel. Well, that setting of piety against learning, of heart against head, of faith against education, has been a motif, usually a minor one, in the history of faith in the Western world especially. I say a minor theme, though I suppose it hardly seemed minor to those who were victims of this enmity, hardly minor to Galileo Galilei, for example, who was forced by the Inquisition to abjure his brilliant explication of the heliocentric Copernican system in 1633. Well, this attitude that faith and learning are enemies found a few champions among the churches of the Reformation and was carried across the Atlantic by some of the early immigrants to the New World. It was more than a rhetorical flourish when the most eminent among the New England theologians, John Cotton, declared that, quoting him, "The more learned and witty you be, the more fit to act for Satan you will be." A graduate himself of the University of Cambridge and a founder of Harvard, Cotton was aware of the challenges that higher education could pose for piety. The tension was much more sharply put in Virginia, where the governor, Sir William Barclay, a BA and MA of Oxford, exclaimed, "Thank God, there are no free schools or printing, for learning has brought disobedience and heresy into the world, and printing has divulged them." The enmity between faith and higher education. Our own Baptist tradition has harbored many persons who stood in Tertullian's long shadow and were suspicious of higher education, even for the leaders of their congregations, perhaps particularly for the leaders of the congregations. As one historian of education has summed up many particulars in the early 19th century, a great many Baptists still believed that a preacher must only open his mouth and God would fill it, and that men who felt the call could, as by miraculous touch, become qualified at once for standing up as teachers of congregations. Hence, as David Benedict concluded a century and a quarter ago, these good old Baptists could not see the need of spending so much time and money to learn how to preach, and they held on to the skirts of the garments of the young brethren with great tenacity who showed any disposition collegeward. That's the way it was a century and a half ago among at least some of our number. Throughout Christian history, there has been this persisting attitude surfacing from time to time that views higher education as an enemy to faith. And from the beginning of the Christian era, of course, there were those centered in the life of the academy who expressed the theme of enmity from the other side, the other way around. They saw faith as the enemy of education. Now, such voices, of course, are usually muted by the fourth Christian century with the establishment of the church as the only legal religion. And then through the long centuries, when the patterns of Christendom dominated Western life, such opinions had little chance for public expression. That opportunity, however, came again during that period that historical shorthand called the Age of Reason, in the late 17th and the 18th centuries. Crane Brinton once indicated that in the late 17th century there arose what he called a new religion, certainly, as he put it, related to, descended from, and by many, reconciled with Christianity. But it was religion, the left side of which, the radical side of which, attacked a faith as an enemy to learning through the tongues of Voltaire and of Olney. They criticized faith as the enemy of true education. Now that's the minor view that through history has viewed faith and higher education in terms of opposition as enemies. It was the other view that Christian faith and higher education are and should be partners that claim the mind and hearts of the majority of Christians through the centuries. Though the many representatives of that general stance could disagree on the details of how to conceive the partnership, how to do the synthesis, they agreed on the main premise. As Luther H. Haschbacher, a prominent 20th century figure in the long line of persons who have been deeply involved in that partnership, summed up the matter, "For 2,000 years, education and religion have been inextricably related, heroically and tragically. This must always be so if the task of transmitting, inculcating, and criticizing their cultures is to continue. For education and religion deal with the questions which are at the very center of human society and culture." End of the quote. Across those two millennia, then, countless persons who were identified with Christian churches organized and maintained schools in which faith and higher education were counted as partners. Proponents of that relationship through the centuries have often quoted, even if a little out of context, such words as those of the prophet Isaiah, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord." And those of Jesus, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." Though the partnership has had a varied history across many decades, it reached a high point in the later Middle Ages when education in the West at all levels was largely the child of the church, and learning of a high order was nurtured in the great universities spawned in the heart of that age of faith. It was an education genuinely devoted to the search for truth. In the 14th century, for example, the church protected 20 to 30,000 students against secular pressures and stood by its conviction that it must support the critics of both society and the church for the health of both. The major movements that we know by the generic title of the Protestant Reformation stressed the primacy of faith. But with few exceptions, they nourished the traditions of learning they had received from the past and added some important new institutions of higher education as these Reformation traditions grew and spread. We sometimes forget that the Reformation was not so long past when the English settlement of North America began. It was only 90 years that Martin Luther prepared his famous 95 Theses that Jamestown was founded, 90 years previous, before the founding occurred. The New England colonies, of course, soon followed, and their Puritan leadership, including John Cotton, whom I've already quoted as being very much aware of the dangers of learning for faith, Puritan fathers soon founded a college in a town appropriately named Cambridge. Though they were very anxious to keep heresy out of their church life, they were sincere in their support for education at all levels, including higher levels. As one historian put it, these Puritan founders of Harvard, secure in their knowledge that this world is God's world, they threw open its doors wide to philosophy and science. In Wurtenbach's words, they accepted knowledge as an ally, had no fear of it as an enemy, since scientific truth could not clash with revealed truth. So the ministers and other educated men sent to England for the latest works of Newton, Halley, Kepler, Boyle, and other great thinkers, and not only accepted their findings, but sought to use the new light which they shed on the wonders of God's world to buttress Christian faith. End quote. Here indeed is a clear expression of the close partnership between the life of faith and the habits of scholarship. That partnership was continued as most of the 9 colleges founded in our colonial period were related directly to a church body. And it flowered even more in the first 6 decades of the 19th century, the period which saw the mushrooming of denominational colleges across the land, hundreds of them, the large majority, over 80% of which have not survived into the 20th century, at least not to the present. At that time, as James Findlay has observed, the religiously controlled colleges were essentially the only system of higher education then available. There were 1 or 2 exceptions, but the public universities and the great private universities did not flourish until the latter part of the 19th century and in the 20th. This time of the flowering of the denominational college was a time when many Baptists overcame their denominational resistance to collegiate education and used their hard-won freedom to found such institutions, for example, as Colby, Columbian, Kalamazoo, Furman, Richmond, Wake Forest, and Baylor. Here, the partnership of faith and higher education was nurtured. Many persons were prepared for the ministry in these denominational schools, but with the real beginning of graduate theological education, when the Congregational Andover Seminary opened its doors in 1808, some Baptist leaders began to see the advantage of graduate institutions of theology. And by 1860, new partnerships of faith and higher education were worked out in such seminaries as those bearing the names of Newton, of Colgate, of Rochester, and of Southern. These schools of piety sought to give proper emphasis to scholarship. One of the leading professors of Bible of that period, Ira Chase, who taught at Columbian College in Washington and then at Newton, sought to guide his ministerial students to sufficiently mature levels of scholarship that they could do their own exegesis and formulate their own theological positions. When his position was expressed in one of his favorite aphorisms that went, "Thorough biblical instruction, not according to the analogy of faith, but according to the laws of exegesis." He was not minimizing faith in that aphorism, but insisting on the proper place of learning, its proper relationship to faith. It was a genuine partnership of faith and learning that he sought. To return to the broader picture of higher education in this period, the potential threat to the partnership that had been posed earlier by Enlightenment thought was largely contained by the increasing dominance of the Scottish common sense realism in the denominational educational enterprises of the time. Reacting against the materialism, the rationalism, and the skepticism that had marked many thinkers of the Enlightenment period, the Scottish realist philosophers viewed the objects which impinge upon human consciousness as given and real, subject to simple natural laws. They believed that analogous to the basic clear patterns of the natural order were equally simple rules for human conduct. For them, what was discoverable through science and psychology was supplemental to what was disclosed in divine revelation, and in no way opposed to that. For them, natural science was defined in a strictly empirical way, and following Francis Bacon, the methods of induction were rigorously employed in the shaping of scientific and other generalizations. And hence, college presidents of the time, many, I think a majority of whom were clergymen, who oftentimes taught the senior class moral philosophy. These teachers could enthusiastically explain that science did not at all conflict with religious orthodoxy. And so, as a recent scholar has summed it up, this Protestant hallowing of Lord Bacon with his inductive method reflected a doxological view of natural science, which styled the scientist a worshipful elucidator of the divine creation. The classical statement of the position at this time was by a leading Baptist minister and educator, president of Brown University, whose famous book, Elements of Moral Science, ran through edition after edition from 1835 for decades thereafter. It was widely adapted by others for their own particular context as they tried to express the partnership of faith and higher education. Brooks Hollifield, for example, exclaims that most of the Southern textbooks in moral thought were therefore revisions or expansions of Wayland, who had combined the rationalist interest in the relations of things with sentimentalist language about motive and feeling. A synthesis, a bringing together of higher learning with faith. All this provided a very neat framework for what appeared to be a highly satisfactory partnership of Christian faith and higher education. Even as the partnership was maintained a little over a century ago, however, tensions and difficulties began to arise. In many institutions, including both colleges and seminaries, there was a pull between an encouragement to faith and to piety and maintaining and raising academic standards. There began to be a tension expressed there. Sometimes those most interested in promoting the alliance of religion and education pressed so hard, struggled so hard to maintain the cozy partnership, that they produced quite the opposite result from their intentions. One of the most prominent advocates of the partnership in the early 19th century was Timothy Dwight, the first Timothy Dwight, influential president of Yale at the dawn of the 19th century. In the interests of faith, students in those days at Yale were required to attend the college church every Sunday, so that no matter what class you joined in the four-year cycle, you get the full round of Dwight's carefully wrought out four-year cycle of sermons. But not everyone who heard or read, because they were published, not everyone who heard or read the great Dwight was persuaded as to his partnership. Not everyone was won to faith by this determined approach. At least once, it backfired. Charles Southwell wrote that on reading Timothy Dwight's sermons, he experienced a feeling like an electric shock which struck my frame. All my thoughts and feelings underwent a change, and I became, involuntarily, without any choice of my own, what I am now, an atheist. You can't win them all. And the attempt at the partnership sometimes produced the opposite result. More often, there was not such a decisive break as that one happened to be, but an increased tension and uncomfortableness in the partnership as developments in the world of education caught some defenders of the faith unprepared. Those who at mid-century felt so secure in their common sense and Baconian bridges between piety and intellect were moving toward unexpected challenges. You see, they had accepted empirical method and the inductive methods. What Dwight Bozeman has written about the strict old school Presbyterians of the middle of the last century was also in a general way true for those of most other persuasions. Form Bozeman writes, in saving antebellum science for doxology, The old school had unwittingly fixed a time bomb to their synthesis of faith and knowledge. The publication of Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species in 1859 triggered a series of explosions which was to work havoc in the intellectual life of conservative Calvinists through the remainder of the century and beyond. End quote. Now, closely coupled with that series of explosions, which Bozeman points to, were those related to the critical approach to the Bible and to tradition, which tended to upset long-established conventions that had been instrumental in helping individuals and institutions to be at home in both religion and education. After the rapid spread in the culture of historical and evolutionary thought, the partnership of faith and learning became so strained that for some it was broken. And eventually, certain of the colleges and some of the seminaries that had been the center of one kind of orthodoxy or another redefined or sometimes broke the links with the denominational traditions which had founded them. The partnership became very strained and sometimes broken. For others, however, new terms for the old partnership were quickly put forth, and many found them congenial. The partnership was patched up. Devout philosophers explained that evolution was God's way of doing things, and believing historians taught that evidence from historical study and from religious experience, after all, supplemented and reinforced each other, and lo, the partnership was healed. For example, George E. Hoare, Baptist church historian and president of Newton Theological Institution, explained this by drawing on an image from architecture to illustrate his point, as in the early 20th century he tried to find new terms for the partnership. Quoting George Hoare, "Sometimes you may have watched the building of an arch. You observe that the springers, leaping from the abutments, hardly sustain their own weight. Often they have to be supported by staging. But when the springers meet in the center, they do not need any staging. Each part supports the others. And you have the arch, the strongest structure known to engineers." Something like that is true in the sphere of Christian apologetics, Hoare said. The evidence from history and the evidence from experience meet, and the two together make up the solid proof. End of his argument. Such proof, of course, didn't convince everybody. Attempts to bring the partners of faith and learning too close evoked reaction once again. Not long before Hoare made those remarks, A Baptist pastor had sharply criticized another Baptist church historian's work, and this time it was Walter Rauschenbusch's famous 1907 book, Christianity and the Social Crisis. Of that, I. Haldeman said, among many other things about Rauschenbusch's book, but among the remarks he said, "Church history is and must always be a peril to the student for the ministry." One person or one group's way of attempting to bring the practice of piety and higher education into relationship leave others completely unsatisfied. And sometimes, of course, individuals get caught in the tensions between the contending parties when the partnership breaks down. A classic case was that at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary when Professor Crawford Howell Toy, whom John A. Broaddus called, quoting, "a shining pearl of learning, not an ordinary star, but a brilliant meteor dropped down among us." Well, Toy found that the evolutionary views of Darwin and Spencer helped him to illuminate the Old Testament
as he did his daily teaching. And he became convinced that God permits the scholar to convey the truth in the form proper to his time. The seminary's president was troubled by such views, but as Pope Duncan tells the story, his agitation was due quite as much to his fear that the teaching of such views in the seminary would offend its supporters. Now, Toy was convinced that his views were quite consistent with the seminary's principles, and in an explanatory paper defending himself, presenting the case for the partnership of faith and higher education. In that explanatory paper, which he thought was going to be accepted, he, to be honest, submitted his resignation, apparently hoped and expected it would not be accepted. That, however, did happen, to his chagrin, when the trustees adopted a report that found, quoting, that there is a divergence in his views of inspiration from those held by our brethren in general, end quote. This is but one of a series of heresy trials in various traditions that ran through the late 19th into the early 20th centuries, all illustrating one way or another how uncomfortable the partnership of faith and higher education can be. Now, the tension can't quite be escaped by going the other way either, by setting rigid limits on the way religion is permitted within higher education's halls, as is decreed by Supreme Court rulings in institutions supported by public funds. The decision in the highly controversial Abingdon School District versus Shemp case in 1963, the one which ruled out daily Bible readings in public schools. Also, almost as an aside, added the words, nothing we have said here indicates that such study of the Bible or of religion, when presented objectively as part of a secular program of education, may not be affected consistently with the First Amendment. That was part of that judgment. That opened the way, it's 1963, that opened the way for extensive advances in the academic study of religion. One way, you see, to try to redefine the partnership from the side of education. Prepared the way for extensive advances in the academic study of religion at both secondary and post-secondary levels. And new departments of religion literally mushroomed across the country in the middle 60s and on into the 70s. Many of them on state campuses and private and non-sectarian private campuses. Yet even this attempt to eliminate the presence of faith within public higher education does not always work. Kelman Bland finds that despite the high fence, the power of faith may break into the secular classroom after all. Even under rigid conditions, Kelman Bland wrote, quoting, neither teachers nor students can escape the sting of religion, especially when they are caught off guard by a swarm of religious ideas in the supposedly protected lecture halls of academic disinterest. Imagine what it must feel like to be scorched during a single hour by the collective voices of Moses and Buddha, Jesus and Mohammed, Plotinus and Heidegger, Freud and Durkheim, Tillich and Barth. Now, I think I put a lot into 50 minutes, but I've never tried that in one 50-minute lecture. But Kelman Bland apparently did and discovered that something of the sting of religion was communicated to his very secular classes. And then Bland goes on to provide several other illustrations about the sting of religion, one of which rings very true to my own teaching experiences, both at a citadel of faith like Union and one of those secular places like Columbia University, where I also teach. Bland wrote, "Students, do not analyze the possible connection between Christian anti-Semitism and the Nazi extermination of 6 million Jews without being profoundly shaken." These indications of the dramatic manner in which the academic study of religion is a powerful reagent in our moral, spiritual, intellectual, and social lives should suffice to prove that the academic study of religion is anything but the innocuous accumulation of mere facts," end quote. Now, what Bland calls religion as study and religion as lived, but what we have discussed here under the headings of faith and higher education, again, show themselves to be partners of a sort, despite the intention to keep them apart. Always potentially an uncomfortable, somewhat difficult partnership. Now, despite those who have seen faith and higher education as enemies and have tried to keep them apart, they are nevertheless both related to deep human needs, hungers, and capacities. The processes of higher education press on ever restlessly in the effort to understand more about the universe, more about this world and all its complexities, more about human society and all its varieties and patterns, more about the self and its depths and heights. We find out some things only to learn that what seems so patently true yesterday is not so clear today. And then we encounter new walls beyond when we thought we were getting to the boundary. We devise new methods to go ever further. But faith, too, is related to human needs and hungers. It's not rooted in them, but it's related to them, human needs and hungers, to the longing to have some kind of comprehensive vision of what life is all about, some orientation into the meaning and the purpose of life, some clues as to the ultimate significance and direction of history. Eric Erickson once remarked that whoever claims that he does not need religion must derive some basic faith from somewhere. So most strands and branches of the Christian tradition have found faith and higher education to be partners and have devoted time, energy, and resources to the cultivation of both of them. As one contemporary author has put it, the activity of scholarship is as necessary to Christian faith as is breathing to the human body. The experience of being grasped by faith in God through Christ under the guidance of the Spirit has been profoundly real to many people through the ages and today. In many lives, Christian faith can be seen and felt to have the capacity to involve the whole being, the whole self, heart, mind. As does learning, faith leads to new discoveries and many times brings us up against new walls of mystery. Memorable saints and seers of history often tell of reaching some mountain peak of faith only to find themselves looking at some explored and higher range beyond, one that had been previously hidden from them. Now, because faith and higher education are both related to human needs and hungers, They often dwell together in individuals and in groups. Many persons thirst after learning because of an orientation to the world that faith has given them. And hence, despite tensions, faith and higher education have remained partners, sometime in very close relationship, as when faith deepens the thirst for knowledge, or when the seeker for truth, coming at it from the side of education, when the seeker for truth is led to probe deeper into questions of value and encounters, perhaps externally at first, encounters the mystery of faith. But the partnership has often been and remains an uncomfortable one. For there are times when religion understood now as the response to faith, oftentimes the institutional response to faith, there are times when religion, so understood, mistakes the unfathomable riches of Christ for its own limited understanding of what the divine gifts are. And when religion does that, it can be betrayed into positions that come close to imperialism or even idolatry. The resources of learning can serve as a useful abrasive in that situation to puncture our pretension, to expose manipulativeness, to reveal tyrannies masked by religious claims. The lines, after all, between superstition and faith, between magic and faith, between fanaticism and faith, have often been and can again be blurred. Here the insatiable curiosity of learning can criticize, illumine, expose, cauterize. And when that happens, however, the partnership between Christian faith and higher education can become very tensioned indeed, and leads some to raise that old Tertullian cry of enmity. But maybe the enemy is within the household of faith, not necessarily out there. Education, too, can be put against rather than for human good. It can be marshaled in the service of despotism and the dictators, used to assist the few rather than the many, exploited to serve limited and private goals and not those of the larger number. Persons of learning can too easily forget how little we really know, and we can settle into an unlovely arrogance, using our knowledge narrowly for our own advantage. And here, faith in God, as known through Christ and the Scriptures, faith that there is an ultimate source of life and that all people are kin, can serve as a very important leaven in learning and can help to give higher education direction so it can more fully serve and not exploit human life. Faith does challenge higher education to use its resources in service to the highest one knows and for others. The sting of faith breaks through again and again. But when faith offers such challenges, it brings tension again into that long and turmoiled relationship between institutions of religion, institutions of faith, and those of education. So the long partnership between faith and higher education, in past and in present, has been and remains always a potentially strained and uncomfortable one. People of faith and people of learning, and part of the dynamics of that tensioned relationship is that so many individuals are both at the same time. People of faith and people of learning have often profited from the corrective of the other side. It is my own hope that the historic connections between Christian faith and higher education will long continue, but that the discomfort of that relationship may never really be dispelled, for each side needs the other. Needs the other as both critic and partner, sometimes as foe, but often as friend. Thank you.
Let us stand for our benediction. Grant us the grace to endure the responsibilities of our freedom and our faith, and grant us the strength to endure your grace through Jesus Christ. Amen.